Hi everyone, my name is Mir and I work at Emerson College Graduate Admissions. We have programs such as creative writing, publishing and writing, popular fiction writing, and publishing. So we're here because we believe in the mission of Boston Book Festival, and we have a lot of writers who are passionate and talented, and we want to drive the change in the industry. So that's why we're here today and sponsoring this session. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Zininjor Enwemeka. I'm a reporter at WBUR, the NPR station in Boston, and I cover a range of issues there, including business, tech, and culture. This afternoon, I'm excited to switch gears a little bit from my usual beat covering business and tech to talk about life, love, and the pursuit of happiness with our two wonderful authors that are joining me here today. And I'd like to introduce them now. So Tracy Strauss, her work has appeared in Glamour, New York Magazine, Huffington Post, and various other outlets. She has also published poetry and has taught at several local universities. Her book, right here, I Just Haven't Met You Yet, Finding Empowerment in Dating, Love, and Life. It offers lessons on love and challenges readers to look at how negative events shape their self-perception and create obstacles to success, and also how to change all of that. So please welcome Tracy Strauss. I also want to introduce Kim McLaren, an award-winning author whose work has been honored by the Massachusetts Center for the Book. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other publications. She is also an associate professor at Emerson. And her book, right here, which I gotta say, I love the title, Womanish, A Grown Black Woman Speaks on Love and Life. This is a collection of essays on dating after divorce, parenting, and a range of other relationship topics. Please join me in welcoming Kim McLaren. All right. So to start, you know, both of these books I found just deeply moving, very personal, really insightful. You both write about life and love. And I'm wondering, what made you want to dive into this topic?
I'll go first.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Crazy.
Well, I think the topic for me was just so organic to my life. And for me as a writer, I've always just processed my life by putting it into words. And it became more than that for me in this process of really wanting to connect with the world around me. I grew up in a very isolated way, and so for me, writing about this topic that was so core to me was a way of kind of coming out into the world and connecting with others. And actually, I think the theme of the Boston Book Festival this year is connections, so that's really prime for me in this topic.
Kim?
I'm a novelist primarily, or at least I have been to this point, and essays have been to me a way to avoid writing a novel, quite frankly. So when I'm struggling with a novel, I just, you know, do a little essay. And so I didn't set out to write this collection of essays. I wrote a couple of essays. They got published in various places. And then I decided to try to put together a collection. And then the question becomes, what threads these essays together. And it's actually a pretty wide-ranging collection. So there are some about relationships. I guess they are about relationships of some kind, but they're about social issues. They're about a lot of other stuff. So these are all things about which I spend my time trying to understand and grapple with and to see as clearly as possible, which I believe is the writer's job, to see things as clearly as mm-hmm. possible and as honestly as possible.
And Kim, I'm wondering, can you explain what the title of your book is, Womanish? What is womanish? How do you define that?
Yeah, so womanish, anybody from the South here? No? Y'all don't know. So, all right. growing up in the South, black people have an expression, you acting womanish. It's said to little girls, and it's not really a compliment. It's more like, oh, you acting like you think you grown, right? Like you're acting like, and Alice Walker, who I take the, you know, used it to create the womanist, right? Her definition of womanist, which is a woman of a feminist of color, a black feminist. And the definition she uses, which I take as my epigraph, is that it's, you know, acting like you have more knowledge than is good for you. But at some phrase, I'm using it in terms of woman, becoming a woman is an achievement. Like we, I always say that everybody gets older, but not everybody grows up, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of grown girls and certainly a lot of grown boys walking around, right? So I view becoming a woman as an accomplishment. It's something I'm very proud of. I'm not, America is this adolescent loving society, and I don't want to be a teenager for the rest of my life because being a woman is an accomplishment, and so that's what it is. I'm womanish. This is the wisdom that I have earned, and it's been hard earned, and I'm proud of it, so.
You should be.
Y'all want to read it.
So I really like that explanation. And Tracy, in your book, you also sort of take readers through this journey of self-discovery of your own womanhood. And is there, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what, you know, putting some of that, some of the things you talk about in this book in there, what that decision thought process was, and I'm wondering if there's anything you wish you had learned or known sooner in life.
Oh, wow. Yeah, definitely. I think we all have that sense from time to time. I mean, the book, similarly to this idea of becoming a woman, right, is for me, my self-perception as a girl and as a teenager was shaped very much by domestic violence and sexual abuse. And so my journey in this, and as I portrayed in the book, is how it is that I went about reclaiming my identity and growing into becoming a woman and what that actually meant. And so a lot of what I have in the book, you know, is a, I think, a very honest, transparent exploration into what are the things that affected my own development growing up socially in particular, and how is it that then I went about realizing what was holding me back from actually becoming the woman that I was born to be and then overcoming those obstacles along the way.
Were you afraid at all to write about some of the topics you dive into? You talk about trauma, abuse.
Yeah. So That's a really good question. So in the beginning, I was afraid because when I disclosed the abuse to my mother, her response was not what I anticipated. It was, you know, don't talk about this. If anyone finds out about this, no one will like us anymore. Mm-hmm. It was very much about how what had happened to me marked me in her view. And at the time, I was really nervous about it, and then I went to, you know, I enrolled in writing workshops and tried to share my story in that way. And some of them were very positive experiences, and others really informed me about this cultural conditioned fear around looking at sexual abuse, talking about it, even acknowledging that it exists, and doing something about it. And so I had to actually make a choice if I was going to really put this in the book or not. And it was the context of my journey. So I learned through these workshops that I needed to address this fear and these reactions on the page. People would get very angry at times reading my story, but angry at me for disclosing the story, not angry at the abuser for abusing. So it was a real education for me in understanding that I had to shape my topic using different writing techniques so that my audience wouldn't turn away, so that my audience would stay on that journey with me. And once I was able to figure that out and try to put it out into the publishing world, then I met up with the publishing industry. And this, you know, it took me over 10 years to publish my book because I was told every step of the way that it was too taboo to mention sexual abuse. So it was, you know, just a process of trying to overcome that. And so for me, it became even more important to have that in there because we cannot change the state of sexual violence until we are willing to actually look at it and see that it exists and not be so afraid of it that we can't do something about it.
And what... Kim, you also get very personal in your book as well. You talk about depression and some other topics. Were you afraid to dive into those topics, and why did you decide to go there?
Yeah, I mean, one good thing about being older is that you're not afraid of this shit anymore, right? I mean, you know, one of my favorite quotes is from the great Audre Lorde, who says, "Your silence will not protect you." Your mm-hmm. silence will not protect you. You know, we think if we sit and be still and be quiet and be nice, then, you know, bad things won't happen and nobody will get angry. And I know that. I mean, I know that mm-hmm. that is, people don't want you to speak. And this is not my first book of essays. I wrote another book of essays, that one was probably a little harder. It wasn't hard. If anybody's heard me speak, they also say that I always say that I have this really wonderful thing for a writer, in that when I'm working on something, I forget that anybody's going to read it. Like, I literally don't think about that, because I'm so focused on getting it, telling the truth and getting it to be what I want it to be. And it's not until it's done and it goes out in the world, and this happened with my first collection, where it's like, oh, crap. wait, people I know are going to read this. And so there was a slight moment in the first collection and then I thought, well, so what, right? Like, I mean, I write very seriously about depression, about suicide, suicidal ideation, about dating, about love, about feeling insecure as a Black woman, about beauty, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, so you know that about me. So what, right? What does that say about me? It says I'm human. And if that's the big secret that I'm letting you folks in on, then, you know, surprise, right? So I mean, and I don't want to be flip about it, because it is hard. But and this is the last thing I'll say, is that when I'm writing, I'm also not just writing about me. I really begin in essays. And I think this is one of the things I took from being a novelist, is that I'm trying to connect, as I'm sure Tracy is too, right? All the great writing is connecting to a larger story, right? So it's about me, but it's not just about me. So by the time I'm finished and it's out there, I don't even think of it as being about me. I mean, people do have a reaction. When my first collection of essays where I wrote about depression, people would come up and say, are you okay? You know, like, and I'd be like, what? I'm fine. Like, what are you talking about? Because at that point, it's already processed and it's gone, right?
Yeah.
So people are dealing with it, but you've already dealt with it.
Right. Right. Yeah. And there's a way in which I think sometimes people get stuck on what you've written, and they see that as your whole existence.
Exactly.
But that's only part.
That's right.
You know, and that's your experience. You've captured that experience.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's a very very important point too, is that we're writing about a piece of our lives.
Yeah.
It's not the entirety of our lives, right? And that's what, so when people read it and they think, oh, I know you, well, you don't really, right? You know this part of me that I have shaped, this narrative that I have shaped. It's the truth. But all writing is shaped in order to make a larger point. So again, to me, it's distanced enough that I don't feel that worry about it. I don't.
And it seems like in both of your books there is this, throughout, it's almost as the reader is following you on this journey of self-discovery in a lot of ways, through your essays, through the way you structured your book, which you mentioned earlier, which is you're writing this letter. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, Kim, you talk about, in a way, different types of relationships through these essays. Romantic relationships, mother-child relationships, the relationship between Black women and white women. I'm wondering, how do...
I was wondering if you were going to mention that one.
Yeah, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm going to go there.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm curious, how do you think these relationships inform who we are, and what is it that you wanted to reveal by diving into these types of relationships?
Those are big questions. I don't set out trying to reveal something. I set out just to explore it. So the piece about mothering was about, if there's a connection between these essays, it's about what do I know now at this age in my 50s about mothering, about love, about relationships between white women and Black women, and how did I come to know that? And what does it mean in the larger context? So those are all the questions I'm really asking. I'm not trying to be prescriptive. It's not, here's what you should do or what you should think. It's really an attempt to just say, here's what I think is happening. Here's as clear as I can see it and as honest as I can be, here's what I think is happening. And y'all can do what you want to do with it after I've laid it out, you know? I mean, it's not like you must do this or you must do that, but here's what I think is happening, because we do have to look at things clearly before we can move on. My idol is James Baldwin, and he was relentlessly clear-eyed about who we are and what we're doing here as people, as a society, as Americans, race issues, and I think you have to start from there. And that's a big thing, because we basically lie to ourselves constantly in this country and in the world, and in just humanity. I have a piece about self-delusion. Is it in this book? I don't remember. Yeah, okay. That's actually my favorite one, because it's about what lies am I telling myself? Because I can see very clearly what lies everybody else is telling themselves, but I have to understand what lies I'm telling myself before I can do that. So.
And shining that kind of light on the truth and your truth and how you see the world, I think, is more important than that you must see it this way,
right.
My audience. Like, you must see it this way because this is how I see it. You are sharing that perspective in a way that I think illuminates the audience, and in that way they join in conversation with you.
Yeah, so another relationship that you both talk about, actually both books sort of open with looking at online dating. And it seems as if there was a bit of self-discovery or exploration that you each had. I'm wondering, what did you learn from that experience, from online dating?
Go ahead.
You can persist, start. Persist, persist.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah.
So there's a chapter in the book called My 1,000th Online Date or something of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I've been on 1,000 of them, but it has sure felt like that.
and not an unreasonable number. I probably came close, yeah.
And I think, what have I learned? I've learned about myself. I mean, I've learned how to trust myself and how to trust my gut. The gut is never wrong. And online dating, anyone can be whoever they want on the screen. But when you finally meet in person, then like the curtain rises and you figure out who this person actually is. And so for me, online dating can be so frustrating, and you know, my single friends and I will gripe about it and, you know, tell our married friends, like, you're so lucky you don't have to do this. But I think it's, for me, it's become a process of self-discovery and also in trusting my gut and just the whole act of putting yourself out there.
Yeah. I wrote about it very particularly as a black woman, from the perspective of being a black woman, because again, right? I mean, we're all humans, but that has to sit side by side by who you are. It has a real impact on how you exist in this society. Like, people often want to say, oh, but you know, as a woman, it's like, no, as a black woman, I had a very different experience than as a white woman. On walking down the street, on online dating, all these kind of experiences. Mm-hmm. It's different. So I wanted to acknowledge that and write about that, and write particularly about what it's like for black women on online dating, because there is this this notion that black, and in fact, if you Google black women online dating, the first 5 hits that'll come up will be articles by black women saying online dating doesn't work for black women, right? And there was that famous study by OkCupid that said, you know, they did that whole thing of who's most desirable and who's least desirable, and guess who's on the bottom of the pile, right? Guess who's on top of the pile, right? So, right, about who gets more hits and who doesn't, right? And so for me, it was about not buying into that myth, which is a larger myth about black beauty and black women desirability in the society and all this kind of stuff. So it was about dismantling that myth in my own head, and actually using online dating, ironically, as a tool to dismantle that myth. Because the reality is, like, just if you go on online dating, I mean, yeah, it's 1,000 dates because 990 of them are losers, but there's 999 men who want to date you.
Right? I mean, like, that's right. And would be, like, thrilled to date you, right? And it is. And so then the story not becomes, oh, won't somebody love me? It becomes, I'm the prize. Mm. Right? It took me a long time to say that. Mm. But I'm the prize. That's what I learned. I am the prize. And most Black women in this society need to learn that. So that's what I used it for.
It's also a really great character study, by the way, as a writer, to just meet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's for sure. A lot of characters. Yeah. Yes.
Any of those characters make it into your future books? Or?
Maybe.
You just want to make sure they don't, like, follow you home and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Kim, you just touched on something that I want to ask you both about, which is the idea of telling a very specific story and an authentic story, and the idea of not being afraid to put that out there or being hesitant to say that this is a story about a Black woman's experience. And I'm wondering, you know, you both explore what it means to be a woman in the world. Can you talk a bit more about the importance of telling your specific story and your perspective and putting it out there in the world, and why we need these types of stories?
I think, well, I mean, we know that we need diverse books, we need diverse narratives. Again, I don't necessarily think about it in those terms when I'm writing, but I do think, I'm not sure how to answer that. Like, I think the person I have become is very intersectional, right, to use the word, and that it is important to for me to articulate that in as clear a way as possible, because I'm not, I don't know how to say it, I'm drawing a blank here. It's a tough question to answer, because I don't think of it in those terms when I'm writing. It's not like I'm writing this book because people need to hear what it's like to be a 50-year-old Black woman. At this stage in my life, I don't really care. I mean, I'm not trying to be flip here, but like, I really am not writing it for that reason. I think I have something. It's like I'm trying to explore these topics, right? The one about motherhood, about mothering a Black son in this society, about what to fear and what not to fear, and how people say you should fear X. Like when my son was going off to France for a year. And people at 16, and people said, "Oh my God, you're going to let him go abroad for a year? Aren't you scared?" I'm like, "He's a Black man in America. What are you, crazy?" I'm more scared when he goes out to my driveway. I had a moment of panic one night when he went out into our driveway to get something out of the car, that the police would drive by and see a Black boy getting something out of the car. That terrifies me far more. So all of which is to say, I'm writing to make that clear, and that does speak to who I am and the perspective that I come from, but I'm not doing it for that reason. Does that answer the question?
Sure, yeah. No, I understand that. I think, you know, what I was sort of getting at is the importance of doing that work, of telling those stories.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for, you know, doing it for a specific audience or for with a specific end goal in mind.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think it's really important to engage and educate your audience about whatever it is that that you've experienced, that you feel that the world needs to know about, to make people aware about. So, I think that that's an act of empowerment, both for the writer and for the reader and the audience, ultimately, no matter the actual, specifics of it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned, Kim, about, you said one of your, you mentioned about your essay. Is there a favorite essay that you have in this book? And can you talk a bit about that?
I like the one on self-delusion, because I think it is the most honest one. I asked myself again, it's easy to look at the world and see what's going on in the world and to judge the world and to judge other people, or at least it's easy for me. It's true, it is, right? But then I have to always check. The writer's job is to check herself, to constantly check herself. And so I started thinking, I need to check myself. Like, what am I lying to myself about? Because I think in a way, many of our problems, our big problems, begin with the lies that we tell ourselves. And we tell ourselves lies all the time about individual, about tribe, about society, about race, about nation. You know, constantly we're lying to ourselves to the point that we don't know it. And certainly our national lies as a country are devastating. The impact is devastating. So before I can go out and wag my finger at my nation, I need to point it at myself and say, what am I lying to myself about, and how can I stop doing that? And so I think that's probably my favorite one. That plus the one about, believe it or not, when I worked in a hospice, which is actually kind of funny, I think, but touching, because I met this woman who was dying. So yeah, those are my two favorites.
Tracy, what about you? What in sort of writing this book and your own journey of self-exploration and looking at your past and dealing with some of those challenges, what have you learned, and what, as you were laying it all out there, was there a particular thing that you were reflecting on that really stood out or was impactful as you went through the writing process?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think, I mean, the structure of the book, it's written as an open love letter to my future life partner, and I had been going to bookstores knowing that, you know, I felt like I had this problem, and the problem was that I was always single, and I was looking for a book that would solve my problem, and I was finding books written by celebrities, and they had, you know, their whole entourage of helpers, and I was this ordinary woman who had a lot of hardships to overcome, and I wanted to see a story written by someone to know how she got to the other side. And so when I was writing the book to my future life partner, it was partly because I wanted to have a conversation with him that I hadn't yet gotten to have, but also it's this idea of disclosure. And so there's a chapter called Disclosure, and I think that was one of the most difficult chapters to write, but also it's one that readers seem to respond to and reach out to me most about. And it talks about when do you disclose to your partner, or really to anyone who you're in relationship with? And what's the timing of that, and how do you know what to say or how much to divulge? And ultimately, it was my realization over the years that in hiding or worrying about people, is this on?
I know.
Sorry.
It's making that noise. There's feedback.
There we go.
Sorry. Okay. In trying to hide my truth, I was sabotaging relationships. And so I had to learn how it was that I could be authentic in a relationship. And so the disclosure chapter is about how I learned how to do that. And the book itself is really disclosure on a number of levels. So that to me was the most important one. And meeting men who disclosed everything to me on a first date, or meeting men who disclosed nothing, yes, like weeks later, and just seeing the gamut. I think it's a big struggle for people, but for me, I've learned that the, you know, putting it out there is really what sets you free and allows you to be authentic in a relationship. And until I learned that being authentic in a relationship was the key to making it work, things weren't working at all for me.
Mm. Now, you mentioned the structure of your book, which is this open letter to your future partner. I'm wondering, I sort of got the sense that it was more so maybe a letter to yourself. Is that an accurate way of looking at it, or... How
that's super interesting. Yeah. It really is designed to be a letter to the future life partner, but I think in many ways there were things that I learned and taught to myself along the way. Yeah, originally the book didn't have the letters in there. It was straight narrative, and I had a couple of sections where I was writing directly to this partner, and in getting feedback on it, people were really drawn to this idea of there's an intimacy to it that I think replicates an intimacy of a relationship, and then the narratives sort of are, you know, illustrate then the journey of that single woman trying to actually find that kind of relationship.
Okay. So the title of this session is Life, Love, and the Pursuit of Happiness. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, what have you both learned about life, love, and the pursuit of happiness?
Go ahead.
well, let's see.
No pressure.
Floss daily and...
That's important.
Yes, exercise. Gosh, that's a big question. I honestly don't know how to begin to answer that. Read the book. I mean, you know, I don't know how to say it without being cliche, right? What, you know, time is passing. This is not a dress rehearsal. And I mean that really, like that, it may be more than anything else. And if you can, for me, once I kind of, which is the reason I did the hospice, right? I wanted to look death in the face and acknowledge the reality that guess what? We're all gonna die. Probably I will too, I'm not sure. And once I really embraced that, which is, it's a scary thing to embrace, but it's actually ultimately a liberation to embrace that, because then so much of this other nonsense really doesn't matter. It really doesn't. Again, including what people think about you if they read that you contemplated suicide. I don't care, right? I mean, because this is life. We're here. It's not a dress rehearsal. So that's a small answer, but that, you know, to be present and to be kind and to be generous and all that other stuff.
Yeah. I think for me, part of what I learned on this journey was that I was always trying to be somebody who I wasn't, and I was always trying to live by the expectations of other people or live by other people's desires and needs, and it just never worked, and I wasn't happy, and I was always looking for happiness in accomplishing something, and if I didn't accomplish it, then I was unhappy. And I thought, if I could only accomplish this, then I will be happy. But what I learned was really that happiness comes from knowing myself and being myself in the world. And to me, that's the ultimate kind of happiness. You can't necessarily change what is going on around you in a general way or other people, but you can really be you, just be you. So that's one thing. The other thing is a sense of humor is essential in the pursuit of happiness. It's hard. Happiness doesn't come easily. If it did, we wouldn't all be trying to pursue it. We would all have it, right? So I think part of it is this, and I tried to do this in the book too, is this levity along the way. How is it that we find laughter on the journey of finding that kind of happiness.
Yeah. I think one thing I would say, because thank you for that, is that one thing I think I know now is that there's a difference between happiness and joy, and that maybe happiness shouldn't be pursued, right? Maybe that's the problem, right? Because life is not always happy, right? There's levity, there's bad things, so that I don't really worry about happiness. One thing that guys used to ask when I'd go on a date, they'd be like, well, what do you do for fun? And my reaction was always like, well, I'm an adult. I mean, I don't do things for fun. I do a lot of things which I enjoy, and I find joy in a lot of the things I do, but I don't do things for fun. So I guess I'm trying to make a distinction between happiness and joy, and I think what you were talking about, being true to yourself, might be a way of not pursuing joy, but allowing joy to enter. And that might be a better way to go about it. That's what I would say.
What do you, did you want to add?
No, go ahead.
Okay. What do you want readers to take away from your book?
The book?
Yes.
Yes.
Which will be available after the session in the back. Besides the book.
Yeah, that's a big and important question. I think readers will take a lot of different things from the book in reading it, but one of the big things that I want people to take away from it is to never give up. And there were many times in my life when I just thought that there was no way to push forward, and then somehow I just kept going. And not just in the experiences that I portray in the book, but also in the publishing industry. So if there are writers out there who are like, this is just not going to happen for me, I've been trying for so long, it's just not going to happen. Well, I was there too, and I was, you know, I was even at a book festival at one point and told that I would, you know, by a professional, that my story would never, I would never move forward because of the context, the sexual abuse context, which is really just one part of my story. There's a lot more to the story than that. So I think I would want readers to just keep going for their dreams and goals, to just keep at it and be you, just be you.
I don't have any idea. I really don't. I don't. You know, there's so much. But I do hate to hear those stories about people saying you will never. I just think that's unconscionable for any teacher, publisher, anybody. As a teacher, that those stories really tick me off. You should never say to somebody that you will never. That's find that person and send me their name. All right.
There are many of them. There are many, and it was all based on fear. It's this fear about looking at certain issues.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. That's an important thing, right? That people, whatever people are reacting to, it's not about you. It's about them.
Yeah.
It's about them.
It seems like that's more of a reason to write about these things and to talk about these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Until we do that, we're not going to change our culture. It's just not going to happen. It's just keeping the you know, people in that same dynamic.
Yeah, your silence will not protect you.
So I'm wondering, and you both, as we've been discussing, you know, we're sort of examining and unpacking a lot of various topics in your lives, and I'm wondering, what's the best piece of advice you have received, and what's the worst piece of advice you have received?
Oh, boy.
About life, love, and happiness?
Oh.
The worst piece of advice I've received is get over it. No matter what that is, get over it, right? It's the best piece of advice. I feel like I'm repeating myself, but it's to be you, to be who you are. It's just, you know, that you give something to the world that other people cannot because they're not you.
Yeah, I don't know. People don't tend to give me advice. or maybe I just don't hear them when they do. That's probably more like it, because I can't think of anything, except my mother did tell me to marry a man who was 7 years older than I am.
Why?
It's oddly specific. I don't know why. I don't think it's quite 7 years, right? So, no. So that didn't work out. And the worst piece of advice, I don't know, people do say a lot of things. When I was dating, people would say a lot of silly things, but I don't remember them because they were silly. So, but I think the best piece of advice is probably be happy with yourself first. Yeah, right? Like, make yourself happy, fall in love with yourself, all of that stuff. Again, it's hard to say these things without sounding cliche, but they're true. They're true, right?
I'm wondering, you sort of touched on this a little bit earlier, Kim, but I'm wondering, are those things you just learn as you get older? Or
not necessarily.
Are there ways to sort of reframe your thinking sort of catch yourself when you're maybe going down that path of either self-doubt or worrying about things that maybe are just trivial?
Again, I am not prescriptive. I don't know. I don't think it happens. I think for me, if there's a theme in the book, it is about not taking for granted that getting older is going to bring wisdom, but that you have to work for it. And so the way I do it is first of all, first and foremost, reading. Reading, 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 right? I mean, why recreate the wheel when so many great people have already done it? That's why I love James Baldwin. If you just read everything James Baldwin wrote, seriously, you will be so far ahead of the curve. Just that alone will, right, will really, so that's the way I do it, is to be constantly looking, exploring, thinking, examining, and examining my own reaction. Last weekend, I learned to ride a motorcycle, and in the first day, I was miserable. I was angry and grumpy and all that kind of stuff. And so, but instead of just going with that, I went home and said, why am I so miserable and grumpy and angry? It's because it's been a long time since I've had to learn something and have not been really good at it right away. And I didn't like that. And I had to admit that to myself. That's why I was being such a bit unpleasant person, right? And so that's, you know, I had to check myself, and that's what you do. So,
in some ways, it's a continuous process.
Yeah.
I think for me, it comes from pushing up against fear. So there's a chapter I have in the book about how I came to try a Zumba class, and I never thought that I would ever find myself in a Zumba class, but I was at the gym and I was on the Stairmaster and I saw this Zumba class going on, and the people looked like they were having so much fun, and I thought, I really want to do that, but I can't because I'll make a fool of myself, or I can't, you know, there were all these reasons why I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I spied on that class for a year.
Oh.
And the trainers in the gym called the instructor, who is a young musical theater student, they called him the epitome of life force. And he just had this joy to him and did not care what anyone mm-hmm. thought of, you know. And one day I finally got up the courage to go in, and it changed my whole perspective on what I could and couldn't do. And I was 40 years old at the time. And I don't think I would have come to that realization if I hadn't taken the risk to go in. And part of that had to do with my trauma, because I held a lot of my trauma in my body. And to dance, you are opening up parts of your body, and if you're storing trauma in there, then these trauma things come out. And so I wasn't ready to do that. And so I'm a big subscriber of, you feel the fear, yeah, well, go right through it and mm-hmm. then see what happens.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And so now we'll turn to, if there are any audience questions, we'd love to hear from you guys. Yeah, right here in the front.
I'd like to
Oh, there's a mic coming for you.
Question?
Right here, in the lady in the front, yeah. In the gray sweater.
Yeah. I'd like to ask Kim if in this age of the hashtag MeToo movement, how has that either amped up or changed your thoughts about becoming an adult woman?
That's a complicated question. I mean, I think it's obviously an important and long overdue movement, and I'm in awe of the women who created that, who started the movement, who had the courage to speak out. I've always known, women always know that that's a, I have a daughter, I raised my daughter, I was very clear with her about how vulnerable you are as a woman in this society and how you have to be constantly on your guard against sexual violence, sexual exploitation, from just walking on the street to, you know, in partners, intimate partners. So I don't know that it has changed it, except that it is giving young women the courage to push back against it, or at least giving them permission, perhaps. I don't know. So I'm in a way that my generation perhaps was not. I mean, we endured that stuff. I worked at the New York Times. I know it was full of unpleasant men taking advantage. And the way you dealt with it then was not the way it's dealt with now. And so I'm glad. I'm very happy for it.
There's another question here. Yeah.
Hi. I just first have a quick comment, which is to Tracy. I'm really sort of blown away that publishers would tell you that sexual abuse is not a topic that people want to read about because of the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. for example. You can see that it's a huge topic. But my question for both of you is, obviously that's both their essays about your personal life, your personal history, and I'm curious about whether if you could sort of talk about the difference between writing about something maybe that happened in your recent past versus something that happened a long time ago, and if it's harder or easier, and how that, you know, because I've thought about writing about things in my past, but some of them are in the distant past. So I'm just kind of curious about how that works for you, either or both.
That's a really good question. I think for me, the longer amount of time there is between the event and my writing about it, the more I've had time to reflect on it, so I'm able to provide more guidance for my reader. So, you know, if I write about a lot of very difficult subject matter and my reader has not gone through my experience, I have, so I need to have a certain amount of distance from it in order to actually help my reader through that difficult terrain. And so if I'm not quite separate from that event, if I haven't done the psychological work necessary to move away from it, then I can't really take care of my reader. So for me, I think it is a benefit to have some space from the event versus writing it. Now, I have written about things that happened, you know, like the week before. Like I had an essay in the Huffington Post about a date that went awry, and it was called Public Service Announcement for a First Date, and it was written as kind of a rant because the person I went out with, it turned out he was still married, and he asked me several times on the date to go home with him, and so these are the things you should not do on a first date based upon this, and I wrote it maybe 2 days after the event happened, and then the Huffington Post picked it up, and then I felt a little bad about it, but. Then I was contacted.
Did you put his name in there?
No, I did not.
Oh, too bad. No.
And then I was contacted by a talk show producer who had read it and asked me to be on the show. And so I feel like sometimes when you're writing about something and it's so fresh in your mind, it comes out in a very intense way that might really captivate people in a way that you never imagine, and other times it's really good to have that reflection, that time for reflection.
Yeah. I would just say, I agree with that. I would just say briefly that for me, again, just speaking for myself, writing can be therapeutic, but this is not therapy.
Yeah.
Right? This is art, or at least is a reasonable approximation that I can achieve, right? I'm writing with I'm not just spilling my guts on the page. I'm constructing a narrative that builds to a point and has some greater meaning than myself. And I think that's an important distinction. As a teacher, I tell my students that, right? And so you do need that distance if you are writing. It's easier if you're writing fiction, right? But if you're writing nonfiction, you do need that kind of distance, I think, from and emotional distance. And that doesn't have to be temporal. You might be able to get emotional distance right away. Or it might take time, but if you're not in control of the narrative, you're not doing your job as a writer. Mm-hmm. I think that's my perspective.
Yeah.
Other questions? Oh, there's a question behind you, the woman in the yellow. Yeah.
Kim, this is for you. You talked about
former student.
Hi. You talked about being. Clear-eyed and how important that is. My question is, what helps you, what keeps you clear-eyed? And also, is there an off button to it? Because the world is
no.
As we know it right now, is terrible. There's so much, and so much about writers having shorter lives because they're constantly looking at the world, at all its trauma,
yes.
And not turning away from it the way other people sometimes or can. How do you go about all of that?
That's a very good question. you need to find an off button. It's very tough. It took me a long time to do it, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what I say in one of the pieces on depression is that, as far as I'm concerned, depression is not seeing things clearly. I think it's actually seeing things too clearly, right? I think that for me it was, I saw very clearly how the world is. You know, ignorance really is bliss, right? Whether it's willful or not. One must find an off button. There was just a piece I saw something yesterday that too much brain activity shortens your life. Did somebody see that? About how, right? There was a study that came out. Nice. The more active your brain, the shorter your life. So, yeah, find something that's going to turn an off button. But there has to be a balance because it is your job. Again, I believe it is my job as a writer. To as James Baldwin said, to illuminate the darkness. And to do that, you got to go into the darkness. And most people don't want to go in there, which is why we have the world we have. Mm-hmm. So somebody's got to go in there.
Hmm. We have time for, yep, there's a question here. The guy in white in the middle there.
So I've got a question using a specific example from Tracy's book, but I think it's more of a general question. And that's, y'all mentioned earlier that there are a lot of things that you touch on in these books. These books aren't about one specific thing, but it seems like there is this reduction to, you know, for example, in Tracy's book, this is a book about sexual violence. It's all about sexual violence. We're not going to publish it because sexual violence. But you write about a lot of things that aren't specifically that. Do either of y'all feel this reduction, maybe people missing the point, maybe people only looking at one aspect of the full story you're trying to paint? Is there an effect that you feel from this reduction?
Yeah, it was really frustrating for me for a number of years. I personally did not want to be defined by that one thing that happened to me. It definitely affected my life in a lot of profound ways, but I didn't want to have that be my sole identity, and I didn't want the book to be seen as having that as its sole identity. And I came to realize that other people, in particular publishers, agents, just got super afraid of that one thing, and it sort of blew up in their minds, like, mm-hmm. This is the thing. And my last agent actually asked me to cut 5 chapters of my book before we submitted it, anything that had darkness to it. I talk about my mother's cancer diagnosis and her passing. I talk about a guy who I semi-dated who ended up being very ill. She wanted me to cut all of that. And I thought, well, if I cut all of that, then what kind of book is this? What's the story? What's the impetus for the journey? Like, this is a universal story about overcoming hardship. That's what it means to be human, whatever the specifics are. And I think a lot of people zero in on the thing that they're afraid of looking at. And part of what I hope to do and try to do in the book is to say, it's okay. You don't have to be so afraid of this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. People like simplicity, right? That's the bottom line. So people always want to reduce things down to their barest element. And, you know, again, part of the challenge, I believe, in becoming a grown-up is to allow for complexity in individuals and societies and every question, right? Was it Faulkner that says the ability to bear 2 conflicting ideas in the mind at the same time without going crazy is the mark of intelligence, something like that, right? So that's a challenge for a lot of people, but that is the challenge. So people do tend to reduce it down to one thing.
And even if with my book, after in 2017 when all the hashtag Me Too was happening, you know, it was at that time when my book was on submission again, and that's when my agent said, you must cut these things, and you may not put the word rape in the book. You may not put it in the proposal. No one is going to publish a book that has that. And I was like, what is this about? Obviously, it's all in the book. I did not agree to cut it because then I felt that there wouldn't be a story. So, I mean, there was still a lot of
complications along the way. But I just think fear sometimes becomes paramount to people actually, you know, being grown-ups about difficult topics.
Yeah. I mean, that experience sort of shows how much further Me Too probably needs to go.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people think it's gone really far, but clearly there are still a lot of obstacles.
Right, yeah. Right.
So we have time for some more questions. I think one more question. There's a woman in the back there.
This is a question for Tracy, and I actually haven't read your book, unfortunately, but one thing I'm wondering is, do you think the struggles that you face in the dating world are specific to women or women in general? And like, how do you think like men fare compared to women currently?
That's a great question. I've actually talked to my male friends about this, and they have the same struggles, surprisingly. Maybe not. I think there tend to be, for heterosexuals, there tend to be more women available than men. So maybe in that sense, you know, we hear more about women having issues. But gosh, I mean, I've had friends share. In fact, there is a passage in the book that I won't divulge at this point. But if you do get the book and read it, it's I have a friend, we would text about our dates after, and we would text about the messages we would get from our online dates, and I mean, it became just absurd, and we would try to one-up the other on what yeah. kinds of things we would hear from people.
There's a lot of crazy women out there, too, so,
yeah.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
Yeah.
My husband says yes, that's right.
So I do think, I mean, it depends who you ask, but in my opinion is it is generally equally dispersed, although I personally feel like it has been more problematic for women in other ways. Like if someone is lying about their age, for example, I feel like, or lying about their appearance, a woman going to meet that man, I feel, is more, at least physically vulnerable than...
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, there's struggles. It's certainly difficult for men, all kinds of stuff. Women lie about their age. Men lie about their age. Men lie about their height. I mean, I'm like, did you think I was not going to notice when you stood up? And, but the difference, as Margaret Atwood says, is that men's biggest fear is that women will laugh at them. Women's biggest fear is that men will kill them. That's the bottom line. Sorry, that was a bummer, huh? Brought the room way down. Last question, happy one.
Okay, we'll take one more question, actually. Is there another question? The woman here in purple.
Hi, thank you both for sharing your experiences. I'm a little hesitant to ask this, Kim, because I don't feel, I'm hesitant, but you had brought it up as well at the beginning in terms of sort of essential differences that you experience as a black woman compared to a white woman, and I'm wondering if you might speak a little bit to that.
In dating or in life?
As you wish.
Oh, boy. yeah, I don't know if we have time for that. It's profound, right? I mean, it's profound in online dating. It's profound in everything. And the one essay we didn't talk about in the book very much, but just briefly, is that there's an essay about the relationship between white women and black women in America, and what that is, and where it lacks support, and on which side. And I think that's a really important essay. Because the first step in that is acknowledging the fact that my experience is very different from white women in every way possible. So that's a great question, but it's way too big to answer right now. But the reality, I think, the most foundational thing is that it is going to be different. And until my white women sisters acknowledge that, there's going to be a rift between us, and that's what the essay says. There is a rift. And that's why. So I thought we were going to have a happy question to end, but I guess not.
Color?
I like yellow. All right.
Red.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of our authors for this great conversation today. Kim McLaren, Tracy Strauss, thank you both for that. And both of their books will be available in the back, so please be sure to check that out. Thank you all so much. Yeah.